Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill.
Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we're thrilled to have Victoria Bennett here with us today, the author of All My Wild Mothers. Hi, Victoria. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So we have a traditional first question on the podcast, and it's, how did you come to the plant path?
I think I came to it through the women in my life. My mother was a keen wild gardener. She was always disapproved of by everybody else in the neighborhood for having a garden full of wildflowers. But that was how I was raised, with her, you know, just growing things that other people didn't want in their gardens. And my eldest sister was a gardener as well earlier in her life, and she taught me a lot about plants. And then later on, with the group that I'm part of, Wild Women, a lot of the women were used plants more sort of holistically and more in terms of kind of magical use of plants and things. So I kind of got introduced to them that way, in a much more sort of word of mouth. So I think that's how I came to plants, and then I've developed it through books and reading and practice, I suppose.
Yeah, that's the best way. All books, reading, practice, personal introductions too.
Mm-hmm.
So this book, All My Wild Mothers, why this book? What prompted this book?
It grew over 10 years.
Wow.
So I started to write it alongside starting to grow the garden with my son that I write about in the book. And it wasn't intentionally a book at first. I kind of started to write short pieces as and when I could. I wanted very much to capture the moments in our lives that we had then, that we were sharing, and also be able to write about some of the things that had happened and the people in my past, particularly my sister, who wasn't with us anymore. And so I would sit down and write as long as I could, and then put it and then close the file and go back to whatever I had to do. And I was doing that alongside the garden, and they grew together. So the garden and the book were sort of both a memoir. And then sort of a couple of years ago, I realized that had grown into a book, that it wanted to be a book.
That's fantastic. It's like an organic process that develops. Yeah. I like how it grew along with your garden.
Yeah, it was, it definitely, the two spoke to each other.
Mm.
And if, you know, if the book is a memoir, then the garden definitely was as well. It kind of held all these memories. And I mean, apart from the sort of the experiences of growing it with my son as he was growing up, it also had plants that had been given to us by friends and by relatives. And, you know, particular plant, I planted a cutting from a forsythia,
uh-huh,
which my mother gave to me.
Mm.
She had taken it from a forsythia tree that was growing in her garden, that had been planted from a cutting from my eldest sister's tree. So there's a sort of this continuation. And now when I've moved, I took a cutting from the tree and I've planted it in the garden that we're in, our new home as well. So it's kind of this traveling through.
I love it, how plants do that, how plants want to be shared, and how, yeah, they can be passed from hands of, yeah, mothers, daughters. My mother always is bringing plants with her every time she visits me to stick in the ground here. And yeah, it seems like that's part of our relationship with the plants, is to be able to spread them and share them. And they just love it. They're there for it.
I love the fact that plants can move as well. It's like, if you put a plant somewhere and it doesn't like it, it's like, where's it gone? And it's like, oh, it's over there. It's changed its mind and it's gone somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you where it needs to be. I like that.
Yeah,
totally.
I also like, for me too, as a gardener, each of the plants in the garden has a story and a backstory, and like where I got this plant, that I found it at this particular forest, found some seeds and planted them, or got it from this particular person. Like, you know, I have these peach pits from Joe Jenkins, who wrote the Humanor Handbook, and they're a rare ripe peach that is hardy in the north here. So it's like each of these plants has its own story. It is like a book, but also like a library, like a living library.
Yeah.
And then, because you kind of, you're lending it out, aren't you? So, you know, when, I mean, I should say really that the garden that we grew, obviously it grew over 10 years and then we moved. Mm-hmm. So, and I couldn't take the garden, the whole garden with us. And it's, we lived in social housing, and the policy over in the UK is that when you move out of social housing, I don't know whether social housing translates to the US, it's welfare housing. So it's, you have to return it to what it was.
Oh.
Which in our case was nothing. Because when we moved in, there was nothing growing in it at all. It was just rubble and then some topsoil. So we had to fill in the ponds, and we had to chop down trees, and we had to do all these things. But obviously, you know, most of the things that were planted in the garden were what would be described as weeds. Mm. So they're kind of tenacious, and they don't easily let go once they've got their home.
Yeah.
That's good. So we did that, and I kind of, but we moved in the winter, so I kind of knew, I was like, okay, I feel safe, but some things will come back. But I didn't know who would move in next. So from our side, what we could do is we took some cuttings, we took a few little plants, dug them up, and gathered seeds. Once we knew we were moving, we started gathering the seeds, which then became the beginning of our new garden. But I've just found out, like, this is just like one of these lovely little stories. I haven't told anybody this yet.
Oh, cool.
So I was messaged on social media by somebody who said they had been given my book, they'd been given All My Wild Mothers as a gift by, I think, by their mother-in-law or something, a relative, not knowing that the where the book was written. Anyway, mm-hmm. She said she got halfway through the book and she started to think, this feels awfully familiar. And she realized she was living in the house.
Wow.
Where the book had been written.
No way.
And she said, so she found me and got in touch. And she said, look, we absolutely love the garden. When spring came, it all just burst into life and all these plants came. And she said, oh, we've never gone. We've got this wild, we love the wild garden. We've just let it go wild. We've just mowed a little patch in the middle and let it go wild. And she sent me photos and it's just full of plants and things. <That's>...
Bravo. That is amazing. Yeah. I'm so glad that you get to like hear from a person who now lives in your old space and like is benefiting from all those beautiful plants. That's so special.
Yeah. And had the book coincidentally, not because of realizing that it was written there. She said it's great as well, because now she could take it out in the garden and identify all the plants.
Yes. Okay. So let's talk plants. Like, what is growing in your garden, or what seeds did you take to your new garden? What are some of the plants that you are super excited about?
The garden now, we filled the garden. Our new garden is very small. And we've absolutely filled it, not really knowing what would grow either. And so some of the things I took with us, so the forsythia, we took calendula seeds. I love calendula. Put it everywhere I can. yarrow is another one. We managed to transplant a very small lavender, which everybody said you'd never be able to grow in Orkney, and it has. So I'm very pleased about that. And mallow. And we actually planted some roses, which we've not done before. They didn't really grow in our other garden very well. So, but I took an apothecary rose that a friend had given. And dandelions, lots of dandelions.
Yeah.
A well-known gardener over here declared earlier this year that a garden isn't a garden if it has a dandelion in it. So.
Oh, no.
And then, Karen.
Well, it just shows the different kinds of gardening styles, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've got, I mean, I've got a lot of lemon balm's another one, and various mints, and so we've got sort of various herbs and hypericum and self-heal. And then as I've been living there, we've started to sort of gather things up. So we've now got quite a lot of honesty growing in there as well, because that grows really well by the sea, and it's just full of color and life and wonderful things to make tea with, which is kind of my daily practice, is to go out and just see whatever's in out there that kind of feels right for the day, and then I'll make a brew for the day and just drink that, sort of see how that works, whether that's to, you know, I like doing it that way around, and then I'll kind of reflect on maybe what the medicinal properties are, but also kind of, well, why have I been drawn to that plant to use that day, and kind of think about its properties as a character and what it's bringing.
What a lovely daily practice. Yeah. Just go out, it gets you outside, first of all, and your feet on the soil and interacting with the plants in the garden, and then just sort of being drawn to the ones, and then the reflective practice of thinking about why. I love that.
Yeah. And I make a big pot and I drink it through the day. So it's kind of then becomes part of my creative practice as well.
It's a really
nice slow way of interacting with the plants and keeping that kind of conversation going that developed when I was writing the book and planting.
That's amazing. And it is with gardens, like as I was hearing your story about your garden and the person who ended up moving there, it just, because I left a garden that I'd worked in for 10 years, you know, and there's something very impermanent about gardens, but also resilient too, because like you had to destroy your whole garden, which it's very sad in a way, but it still came back up, you know. And that's what's amazing about the plants that can do that, those common plants that like to be around humans, you know, and grow well around humans and have all of these wonderful helping qualities for humans. Because I mean, yeah, Orkney compared to Cumbria, I guess, is probably a very different climate, and also compared to where we are in New York. But a lot of those plants are plants that we also grow, and just they kind of grow themselves in a way.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not what would be thought of as a gardener. It's like I am very much kind of, you stick it in the ground. If it comes up, it wants to be there.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, the apothecary garden, I was planting it alongside grief. So I was having that as part of my life, but also alongside being a full-time caregiver for my son, who was young at the time, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 2. And I was a caregiver for my mother as well during that time at end-of-life care, and for my elderly father. So, you know, in many respects, the garden had to grow itself. And combined with that, we had no money. So, you know, a lot of the kind of things that say what a garden should be and what plants we should, you know, the word giving it away, what we should grow, is there to kind of make us spend money and kind of buy into that whole kind of capitalist model of exchange. But in actual fact, if we grow what grows well and kind of with resilience in the area that we live, then the gardens kind of want to be there.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's, I try and listen as much as possible to what plants do, because I think we're kind of pretty much the same thing. And if we behave in a similar way, then we're probably doing all right.
Totally.
Yeah, and I think that those plants that want to grow are the ones that have some of the best medicine, especially for you. And you're, by consuming those plants and taking them into yourself, they help you with that resilience.
I mean, as well as kind of that the knowledge that we've lost along the way as well, of you know, which is part of what I ended up writing about, which is, you know, there's the knowledge that I've been passed on through the women in my life, the older women in my life, but also there's a whole lineage really of mostly women, not all women, but mostly women that pass that information on. So a lot of the plants that are in my book which were all plants that grew in the garden, except for the last one. Oh, no, except for two. Sorry, there's one. One laburnum didn't grow in my garden, but it grew in my childhood garden. And gorse didn't grow in the garden, but strangely enough, grows very prolifically where I now live. So maybe it was prophetic.
Wow, nice. That's interesting.
So these, I completely lost my thread. I got totally absorbed then in the plants.
Well, you're talking about like the mothers passing on things to their daughters, women, and...
That knowledge, that you know, the knowledge of what grows under our feet, you know, that the plant medicine that's there and the properties that come with it. One of the things I noticed with a lot of the plants that were growing in my garden is that they were linked with things like grief. They were linked with things like healing, and also very much with different points in a female body's life, you know, to do with childbirth and menopause and all of these things that kind of, you could see in their history, you know, rooted in that history, this passing on of knowledge that in my life had, you know, although I had learned plant knowledge from my mother and my elder sister, there was some of that connection missing in terms of teaching, you know, that had broken down in a kind of culture that didn't encourage women to engage with their bodies and kind of that sort of natural cycles of things. So I think that there's so much that the plants can teach that we know, but we've forgotten that we know.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell us a little bit more about how the plants that you chose for the book came in to be a part of the book?
Well, partly practically, they, like I said, they grew there.
Right.
So sometimes the chapters are directly linked with the plants in that I may have written about something. So that for example, there's a chapter on blackcurrants that's linked with picking blackcurrants. So sometimes they're very obviously connected and that's why they're there. But mostly they connect with what's going to happen next, kind of. So they're sort of prophetic in that way. And they're linked with, I suppose that, you know, as a whole, the garden supported me. It supported me as a healing garden in growing it. And as I was growing it, I was learning more about the plants. And so the plants supported me in a sort of a deeper level. And then every single plant grows where something in wasteland, where things are broken, because it had to, practically it had to, because we were growing in the rubble of an old industrial site. But also metaphorically, the plants, that was what I was growing in. I was growing in the rubble of grief. I was growing in ground that was broken. And this was what was growing. So that's how the plants kind of talk with the book and why they're there, because they were the things. I think I thought nothing would grow. I'd been through so many losses. And, you know, there are three deaths in the book. And and also miscarriage before I had my son. But there were other losses that were not in the book. And I had been through so many that when we moved there, I really needed to see if something would grow. And so being faced with this ground that seemingly nothing would grow in was you know, I just stuck the first thing in.
Yeah.
And I suppose the plants helped me in that way. As they grew, they helped me, reminded me of what can grow, and also reminded me of, and showed me the healing that can come from that, but also the beauty that's there. So kind of we can write things off and go, well, we, you know, nothing will grow, everything's bad, you know, life is bad, people die, terrible things happen, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Or put a seed in the ground and see what happens, really.
Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor of growing in the broken soil for dealing with the feelings of brokenness that come with grief. I want to maybe talk about some of the specific plants that you mentioned in the book, like maybe broadleaf dock. You say to carry the seeds to help you conceive a child, and it also releases anger and anxieties and old pain. Do you want to talk a little bit more about Rumex obtusifolius?
And it's not a plant really that people, you know, people don't really think of it as being something that they would use.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's the, you know, you sting yourself with a nettle, you rub a dock leaf on. So yeah. it is in one way, it's a plant that everybody knows. It's kind of, you know, if nothing else, most people know if you sting yourself with a nettle, you rub yourself with a dock leaf. So it is something that we've carried with us. But to know that you can eat it, to know that you can use the leaves, to know that you can use the seeds, to know that it can be used medicinally is kind of, it's been a surprise for people when they you know, that's one of the ones where people are like, oh, I never realized that but for starters, never realized you could eat it.
Yeah.
And if we're honest, some plants, you know, we can eat them, but we're probably not necessarily going to choose them over something that tastes a bit tastier, are we?
Yeah. I do like the young dock leaves. They're a little more sour and not as bitter, but they get pretty bitter.
Yeah, once you get, and I kind of think that that's its character as well. There's a bitterness that comes with it. And I think it's a really good reminder of kind of not holding on to that bitterness as we grow older as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like the dock because it's a much maligned plant that people don't want in their gardens, and that's like, nah, keep it, grow it.
Yeah. Or dig it up and use the roots for medicine, make an extract out of the roots or dry them for tea. Yeah.
You know, crush the seeds, you know, it's kind of that, you know, it's like, I mean, dandelion is a classic one. And I think, again, that's one now that is becoming more in people's consciousness. But the fact that a dandelion, you know, you can use the roots, can't you? You can, you know, the roots are excellent. The leaves are excellent. You know, it's kind of, it's food, it's medicine, it's tea, you know, it's kind of.
You make your wishes on the seeds.
Yeah, it's a pollinator. It's kind of, it's all of these things. So at all stages in its life as well, which is another thing which I really like, that as a reflection that, you know, because there's a bit of a kind of, in the culture that we're in, I think this is that there's a little bit of a kind of, as you age you're not as important, and maybe when you're younger you're not as important. You know, there's this prime time that you're supposed to be used, but you take something like a dandelion and actually it's got value all the way through, which I like that about the dandelion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every part of its cycle, it's got something to offer.
Yeah.
I also like the flowers are wonderful. I just eat them, you know, in the spring, make wine. You can make dandelion wine with them.
Yeah. That was a favorite with, well, not my grandparents, but my mother's grandparents, so you're going back a long time then. She had memories of kind of dandelion wine and stuff.
So good.
And mead, that would be a good one over here.
Yeah.
Mead is a popular one, especially in Orkney. That would have been a kind of a traditional one as well.
Mm-hmm. And Lady's Mantle also made it into your book. And one of the aspects of it is helping you overcome fears of childbirth. I was wondering if you wanted to talk more about Lady's Mantle too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to confess to it, I'm not a herbalist, so I will struggle to give you a load of information about plants.
All right. Yeah, just your experience. But that's all.
Well, Lady's Mantle, that's one of those ones that I can remember from being a child.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And kind of catching the dew cups. You know, it's kind of that fairy dew.
Yes.
In the morning, and being sort of me, my friend and I kind of rubbing it on our cheeks. Oh, we're making ourselves beautiful. So the fact is, we were doing that as part of play with no knowledge that that was actually part of the property of the plant.
Wow.
And part of its history. So how did we know that as children?
Yeah, that's really cool.
Right. Putting on that, that Venus energy onto your face.
So, you know, I've always been drawn to it. I've always loved it as a plant, and it's so deeply rooted in female cycles, to, you know, to do with, I mean, even sort of it's rooted in miscarriage as well. You know, it's one of the plants that's used there, and it's and even with sort of menstrual issues, and it's like, and then again in menopause. So it's one of these plants that actually carries through a woman's life, which I think is very special. But how did I, you know, that's that question. How did I know to instinctively go to that plant as a young girl and choose it?
Really interesting. Yeah. So, you know, obviously nature and the plants have offered you so much comfort and so many lessons in your process of healing and moving through grief. And I'm hoping you can maybe speak more to how nature can offer us resiliency in times of struggle.
I think it's, well, I mean, I think there's two things going on at the moment. I think nature is expressing that struggle extremely loudly. I think that, you know, when I kind of look at what's happening, it's, you know, I find correlations between kind of the Mother Earth and kind of the archetypal kind of howling crone.
Yeah.
Kind of crying out and saying, you know, and flushing all the place.
Yeah.
And really kind of raging about what's happening. So that's as an aside, I suppose. I think with my experience with growing the garden and with sort of slowing down and being and making plants part of my, very much part of my life and very much part of my motherhood experience of raising my son, they do teach resilience, because, you know, they will grow where you think they won't. So that's one thing to kind of to take in and go, this is okay. You know, I don't need the perfect surroundings, the perfect ground, the perfect this or that or whatever to be able to create, to be able to grow. You know, I just need to get my roots firm in. And then there's kind of, and then the basic needs, you know, it needs nurturance in terms of it needs water, it needs light, it needs warmth, you know, and those are the things we need as well in terms of tenderness and love around us and co-creators as well, because if you plant all the same plant, it doesn't do so well. So if you look at how plants need each other and rely on each other, and the ones that you think, oh, we shouldn't have that, let's take that out, that's too, you know, that's not meant to be in there, but you take it out, and then the one you want to grow doesn't grow as well because it needs it. So that kind of, that's something I think that is important for us to keep in mind, particularly now, that we need each other. Mm. And we need that support of each other. And sometimes something that doesn't seem like it's what you want is exactly what is needed at that moment to grow as well. I think that's something that kind of the plants have been more sort of daily sort of connected to, the plants have shown. And also that they die off, you know, that's the other thing. They do, you know, they don't survive sometimes. And sometimes, you know, I've just left, come down south from Orkney, and we've just had 2 weeks of storms. So what was remaining in the garden, kind of that late flowering, just got flattened completely and completely salt scorched. So everything was blackened, and it's like, it happens, you know.
It's the season.
Yeah. And sometimes that's what, you know, that's what life is, really. I mean, I don't think we're any different to plants, really. You know, people talk about biodiversity like it's something that we're not part of. And it's sort of happening out there. It's like, but we're not. We're all part of it, aren't we? So,
yeah. I mean, we can photosynthesize vitamin D. We have, what, 90% of the cells in our body are other bacteria and fungi. It's, yeah, we are biodiversity. But it also, the garden also comes back in the spring, you know, like we have this death in the fall and in the winter and this time of slumber and sleep. And even though, even if maybe not all the plants grow again, there are plants that do, most of them do come back in some way. And I think that helps sometimes with that, just seeing that cycle every year. And each plant goes through its own cycle of slumbering, of growing, of flowering, of going to seed. And that's, to me, it helps me find my place in that cycle, in my, you know, because we are going through that cycle too. And it helps me metabolize grief in a certain way, you know. But yeah, so how grief is a big part of this book. And do you think you could share with us your experience with growing through grief and what it means to you? And yeah, those sorts of things.
The big one.
Yeah, it's just a small little topic.
The book starts with, it starts a few years on from, but it starts with really the fallout of a traumatic death with my sister. My older sister drowned, and that experience of sudden grief, of what I call kind of complex traumatic grief that came about from a sudden death, was quite a physiological experience of grief. You know, it changed me. I mean, not only it changed my body, I was pregnant at the time, and the shock kind of had a repercussion through my body. So, I mean, I nearly miscarried. I went into early birth, and I ended up in a wheelchair for a while because I couldn't walk. And, you know, so there was kind of a physiological response to grief. And it was such a shocking, I mean, we all kind of know we're mortal, don't we? We know we are.
Somewhere in there.
But I'd experienced grief through miscarriage before that. So there was a kind of already living with loss when this happened. And that kind of brought with it its own journey to make in terms of feeling like I wasn't good enough to have a child, that it was my fault, that there was doing something, that there was something wrong inside of me that made that the case. And then I conceived after the doctor said I would never do that. And I conceived, and I was kind of coming to accept that this was going to be a pregnancy that was going to last. And then my sister died, which was just 2.5 months before my son was born.
Mm.
Kind of this, you know, talk about a metaphor of birth and death. It was like really crammed them in together at the same time. So,
yeah.
So it's almost impossible to take apart my experience of motherhood from my experience of grief.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things are knitted together, which I'm kind of going off on a tangent that you weren't thinking of here, but I'm just thinking that it's because of that, it became something very deep inside of me. I couldn't process it quickly because I was also having to concentrate on being pregnant and birthing and being in this world that was all about life. Motherhood doesn't give much space. Our culture of motherhood doesn't give much space for grief either. And contradictory feelings as well of kind of this deep love and wonder at my child and being born alongside a deep loss and grieving for my sister who had died. So those two things kind of grew in there with me at the same time. And I think maybe because of that, the experience of grief became quite stretched.
Mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't kind of do everything at the beginning. I mean, I don't think we grieve all at the beginning and then it's all done, but, you know, there was this sort of having to stretch it. And then my son became ill and nearly died from type 1 diabetes because it wasn't diagnosed at first. So there was another grief there that came in. So that was only, you know, it was like every 18 months.
Oh, man.
There was another trauma. So it was kind of that death. And then my sister-in-law died. And then I was diagnosed with a chronic illness that was quite life impacting. And then my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And it's like, so there was this 8 years where I was either grieving or in shock from somebody dying or becoming very ill or myself becoming ill. So there was all these life changes happening while my son was growing at the same time. Mm. And that taught me a lot about grief, a lot about mortality. People have asked me, would I change it? Would I go back and change it? And I always think I have two answers to that. Yes, of course I would.
Yeah.
Because all of those people, you know, particularly my sister, had so much more life that was there to be lived. And yes, of course, I would go back and take the suffering away from everybody who suffered. And at the same time, no, I wouldn't change it at all. Because oddly, and it's the kind of one that people, I try and say it to people, they go, unless they've been through it, maybe, that amount of grief and that amount of loss actually made me a more joyful person at the end of it. Because I think up until that point, I still held on to that idea that there was a thing that was called happiness, that there was a thing that was kind of ideal.
Yeah.
And then after that, I realized that there is just what we have, you know, right in this moment. And it is terrible. And it's devastating and it's beautiful and it's full of wonder and it's magical and it's annoying and mundane. it's all of these things, all in every single moment that we have. And that's not the same as when people would say, oh, you know, people say, after my sister died, oh, but doesn't it make you live in the moment? And it's like, yes, and the moment's really, really crap. So
yeah.
So it's not great, okay?
Great.
Aww. I don't know. I think that's probably a very long answer and maybe not what you were asking, but no, I think exactly. It's just
perfect.
Yeah. It's full of grief and it's full of life. I think those two things have to go hand in hand.
Yeah, it seems sometimes when you're in that, especially the beginning stages of grief, like of a sudden loss, that you'll never be able to find joy and find happiness again, you know, and sometimes that can masticize into like a stagnancy or anger that you just can't let go of. And I'm wondering, like, I'm sure you've gone through all of those different phases. And I'm wondering if you have any words of advice for people who are kind of stuck in that feeling of they won't be able to get over it, or they're just so full of anger that they can't find the joy.
I think realistically, it's accepting that that grief will stay with you forever. Mm-hmm. You know, I still have days where I am hit winded from the side,
right,
by it, and I will find myself howling.
Yeah.
And I will miss, you know, I will miss my sister more sometimes now than I did at the beginning, and it'll hurt as much, if not more, sometimes. And I've kind of come to terms that I think it's that knowing that that will be there, that there isn't a staging of grief where you'll get over it.
Right.
But grief changes you, it reshapes you. It's like, it is like the barbed wire in the tree. You know, you're not going to change it. It's going to be in there, but that scar's going to be in there, but keep growing with it. So it's kind of accepting that that's there is one thing. And then I also think there's value in kind of just going, I'll just get through this next moment. I'll just get through this next hour, this next day, and just being present and being a bit, you know, that's where the plants really helped me. It's kind of just be present in it and accept, you know, is that present in the moment, isn't it? You know, it's kind of breathe in, breathe out, be present. And know you can, you know, if it feels like you can't get through the whole day, then just get through the next 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And the next 10 minutes and the next 10 minutes. Break it down into whatever does feel manageable. That's really and good. Get through that.
Yeah.
And then just add it on. And then the other thing is find something. Now, for me, it was the garden,
mm-hmm.
but find something to plant your hope in.
Yeah.
Find something outside of that anger to just look after.
Mm.
Yeah? Because I think grief as well can, it can stop us looking after ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, so because maybe we're not, why should we still be here? Why should, you know, why should we still be having a life? Why should we still be enjoying ourselves? Why should,
yeah,
should we still have all of these things? So maybe that self-care goes away
mm-hmm.
because there's a guilt in there. So sometimes looking after something else, whether it's a plant or, you know, or just being outside for a moment, just being in the bigger space is important, I think, to remember, because it helps, you know, like that cycle of the plants, like the cycle of the weather, the cycles of the moon, you know, it helps to remind ourselves that things change and come back and change and come back. And then there's certain plants that I would.
Yeah, that was my next question was, are there certain plants that, you know, can help with that grief or the anger, or, you know, what you're dealing with?
I mean, for me, yeah. I mean, I think that everybody has to find their own
mm-hmm.
plants, whether that's through researching them or whether it's just an intuitive movement towards them. But for me, borage was one.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
It's a really good one for helping with that kind of self-care and a gentle working on that blocked energy and kind of that feeling of feeling hard. Yeah. And it's still one that I use a lot of. Rosebay willow herb is another one that I find, and I found good for that. And I mean, it's one of the reasons I chose it as the starting plant in the book, because it's that releasing stuck energy.
Mm.
And it grows, you know, the kind of the whole point of the rosemary willow herb is it grows where everything's been scorched. It's scorched ground time, and it will grow. So I like to, you know, for me, choosing plants that had the energy that I needed.
Mm.
So the rosemary willow herb would grow where everything else would burn and been destroyed. So right at that starting point, I needed that energy of being able to grow. And it's also, you know, it has the properties that I needed. It kind of, I found when I started looking into the plants, because I did it in reverse. I didn't come to the plants with the herbalist knowledge. I kind of came at it the other way. You know, a lot of the plants I was choosing were anti-inflammatory.
Mm.
When I was working with that, you know, when I was feeling that anger and stuff, they were to do with kind of reducing that inflamed feeling, or they were things that were sort of diuretics, so they were kind of, or cleansing, so they were to do with kind of breaking stuff down. And I think that that's all of that together, really. I just sort of know that I think that grief lasts a lifetime. And as Jane Hirschfield poem, and I'm terrible at remembering things, so I'm probably not the best person to try and quote it, but I think it's called The Weighing. And in the poem, some life, you know, life asks us for everything we have, and we give it, and then it asks for more.
Wow.
And we give it.
Hmm.
It's like, and that, you know, there's so much sadness, you know. I wish I could remember the poem because it's very beautiful, and I'm sorry, Jane Hirschfield, for doing this dear poem. But, you know, there's so much sadness, and there's so few grains of happiness, and yet the two balance out. And I think it's remembering that as well, that when it feels at its darkest, you know, it's a bit of a trite thing to say, but it's holding on in those points, because happiness, there are moments of happiness, and they may never be equal size to the depth of the loss, but somehow they balance out.
That's very affirming to hear. Yeah. So So just one last question. As a caretaker, a carer, you know, of people that you love and for yourself, how do you keep your cup full as you're giving so much to others?
Probably not very well at times. I mean, I think the reality of being a caregiver is that there are times when that cup is going to be not only empty, but positively tipped upside down.
Yes, for sure.
But, you know, in those moments, I always try and have, I mean, like I said, my daily practice of kind of choosing plants to have a tea, you know, that came about out of necessity in a way. Because yeah. One of the things I could do when I was nursing my mother was I could one cup of tea a day. It's like there would be a moment. So I had a lovely cup.
Yeah.
And I had a nice teapot. Mm-hmm. And I created a tea that I could. So I would, in the morning, you know, there would be a moment in the morning where I could go outside and I would try and go outside with bare feet and I would choose some plants and I would make a pot of tea and then I had my nice cup. And even if I only got a sip out of it at a time, there was a ritual in there. So it's creating little rituals that sustain you. Kind of important, I think, as a caregiver. Because, you know, there's no point. It's the thing that everybody says to caregivers. You need to make time for yourself. And it's like, well, are you offering to come in and do the care then? Because, you know, you are.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is I can't do that. So, but we can find little rituals, little things. So I had a particularly soft jumper that I wore that had a hood.
Perfect.
So yes. When I was feeling, you know, when I was feeling really vulnerable and worn out, I would kind of just put my hood up and rub the jumper.
Yes. Love that.
So yeah, little rituals, little self-comforts that mm-hmm. can live alongside all of the care. And then like things like the writing is another example, I suppose. When I knew I wanted to write, I knew I couldn't have loads of time to do that. You know, there was no point. People said, oh, you know, you need to get up in the morning and do 3 hours before you. And it's like, well, I'm up all night. So what's getting up in the morning?
Yeah.
But what I did was light a candle.
Oh.
So when there was a moment where I wasn't having to do the looking after, you know, and they happen, you know, sometimes everybody goes to sleep at the same time. And it's like,
yes.
So I would light a candle and I would write. And then when I had to go and do the care, because there would have been an alarm, no doubt, that went off somewhere, I would blow the candle out and I would stop writing. But for that point where I had the candle lit, that was my space. Nice. And sometimes that was a minute, mm-hmm. you know, maybe two. Sometimes it was a bit longer, mm-hmm. but that was mine. If the candle was lit, that was my space. And I knew I was safe to take it because I knew as well that I could blow that candle out and go and do the care that needed to be done. So,
yeah, that's beautiful. Creating those rituals is so important. Really great advice. So thank you so much, Victoria, for sharing all of your wisdom some of your wisdom with us today and for writing this beautiful memoir. And if folks want to buy your book or learn more about you, where do you recommend they go?
Well, I've got a website, which is victoriabennett.me. So that's got information about the book. It's also got quite a few some of my favorite tea brews. So if people want to go and see some of them, sort of see what plants I'm using in those teas and links to other places. So I think that's probably the easiest place to remember to go to. Otherwise, I'm on Instagram as BeeWild, which is BeeWyld.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here, Victoria.
Oh, it's been lovely. It's been really wonderful to meet you. And thanks for inviting me along.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cheers. Enjoy the rest of your day.